Well, it's the fourth and final session of the day. It's the first in our class on Daniel. I'll just begin by reading to you the description I received from the congregation. Quote, "The book of Daniel contains a great deal of information that many find hard to understand. However, it also contains stories that are very familiar to children as well as adults. Please include both parts of the book in your discussion. When addressing the prophecies, please discuss their fulfillments and their effect on history. Please include in the discussion the method used for counting the time factors involved with the prophecies. Finally, it was stated that the goal of this class is to provide a fuller understanding of the prophecies contained in the book and their fulfillment." So kind of a tentative plan I have for our study, and this will go both weeks, God permitting, is that we will spend the first 4 days thereabouts of our week introducing the book, looking at information related to the book, questions related to the book, and those first 6 chapters of narrative. And then by Friday, at the very least, begin chapter 7 with the prophecies and be there, of course, until we finish out the study. And I hope that will meet with the desires of those in power. Let's introduce the book by introducing the man. The man Daniel shares his name with at least two other men in the Bible. 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verse 1, David had a son by Abigail, who's named Daniel. We have a Levite of the family of Ithamar in Ezra chapter 8, verse 2, possibly also Nehemiah chapter 10, verse 6, named Daniel. Does anyone know what the name Daniel means? God is judge, or judge of God. Gesenius tells us it means God's judge, the one who delivers judgment in the name of God. I don't know why Daniel was given that name, and unlike is the case with some prophets in the Bible, I don't see any immediate connection between the meaning of Daniel's name and its prophecy, but it's maybe a nice piece of information to have. Contemporary testimony in the Bible testifies to Daniel's outstanding qualities. He was no ordinary average guy. Ezekiel tells us, and Ezekiel was one of Daniel's contemporaries, Ezekiel 14, starting in verse 13, God says through Ezekiel, "Son of man," this is Ezekiel 14, beginning in verse 13, "Son of man, when a land sins against me by persistent unfaithfulness, I will stretch out my hand against it. I will cut off its supply of bread and send famine on it and cut off man and beast from it, even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it. They would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, says the Lord God." The very one before whom we ought to be righteous says of Daniel, he is righteous, not righteous enough to save this land, but he is righteous. God also said of Daniel that he was wise, speaking sarcastically to the prince of Tyre in Ezekiel 28, verse 3. God says, "Behold, you are wiser than Daniel. There's no secret that can be hid from you." So we see a man who's testified as being righteous and wise, and of course we know all these things to be true and noteworthy that God is the one saying these things of him. We have a more minute account of Daniel's early life than we have of any other prophet, as far as I know. You know, we can go to some of the prophets and kind of piece some things together about him. Amos, for example, we know he was among the sheep breeders of Tekoa. We know he was a tender of sycamore fruit. Some of them we can learn a little bit about, but only with Daniel, as far as I know, do we have so much information, particularly about his young life. He was, according to Daniel chapter 1, taken by the Babylonians in the first captivity. And that's going to be about 606 B.C. I know some of these dates are very familiar to some of you and less so to others. I think we've got a pretty broad age spectrum here. But about 606 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar comes against the city of Jerusalem, 605 some will say, during the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim. And this is the captivity in which Daniel is taken away. That's recorded for us in Daniel 1, 1 through 4. It's also recorded for us in 2 Chronicles 36, 2 Chronicles 36, verses 5 through 7. The other two, of course, were in 597 B.C. and about 586 B.C. Some will say 587, but I like those. They're a little easier to work with. And that allows me to go from 606 to 536 is 70 years. Remember the prophecy, they would be in captivity 70 years. What happened in 536? First return. Yeah, the first return is Zerubbabel. And then if I go 70 years from this date, that puts me at 516. What happened then? Temple was completed. So it's kind of a neat little way to remember it. I don't know that second set of 70 years was intended in the prophecy, but it's a nice mnemonic device, I think. That second captivity is recorded for us in 2 Kings 24, 2 Kings 24, 8 through 16. and 2 Chronicles 36:10. 2 Chronicles 36:10. That was under the reign of Jehoiachin, who reigned just 3 months and 10 days. And then the third one, of course, is under the reign of Zedekiah, his 11th and final year. And that's also in 2 Kings 25 and 2 Chronicles 36. Let's turn to Daniel 1 and get a little bit of the information that Daniel gives us about that first taking. Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. We're in verse 2 now. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, that's into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. We'll talk more about that second verse tomorrow, probably, but just to note that in this first captivity, the tearing down of the temple began. The structure wasn't hindered so far as we know, but he began to cart the things out of it. By the time it's done, he's taking everything out of it pretty much. But here in chapter 1, verse 2, in the first taking, some of the articles were taken out. 2 Chronicles 36, verse 6 tells us that Jehoiakim was bound. Jehoiakim the king was bound in bronze fetters, ready at least to be carted off to Babylon. There seems to be some question as to whether or not he ever got there. But we see the temple plundered, we see the king bound, and then in verses 3 and 4, if you're still there, the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And Daniel was in this number because verse 6 tells us so. From among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And it is here that we get some of our information about Daniel. He met the qualifications for these men who were to be taken. He was a young man. I know the King James says children, the ASV, NAS, and ESV say youths, the NIV agrees with the New King James saying young man. The word is a little slippery. This word in the original can mean a child, like one recently born, all the way up to a young man, whatever that might mean. I've heard different estimates. Ignatius said that he was about 12. John Chrysostom said 18. Somewhere in there, maybe a tween or mid-teen, somewhere in there is probably where Daniel fell. He may have been made into a literal eunuch at this age. I know it does say eunuch here, and you might say, well, what's the question? Well, the question, again, revolves around this word. And by the way, verse 1, chapter 1, verse 3, notice it was Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs. That's how we know the eunuchs in question here. 6 times in this chapter we're going to read of the chief of the eunuchs. 2 different positions, but eunuchs keeps coming up. The question, again, revolves around the word, because this word, although it can literally mean a male who has been castrated, it doesn't always mean that. Gesenius tells us that this word eunuch can refer to any minister of the court, although not castrated, and he points out that it's difficult to determine in what places the primary meaning of the word is preserved and in what places it's lost. So, maybe that happened to him, maybe it didn't. If he was literally made a eunuch, that would fit with the fact a wife is not mentioned. Just because she's not mentioned doesn't mean she wasn't there, but it's a possibility. Remember his contemporary Ezekiel. Did Ezekiel have a wife? Absolutely. And you recall that Ezekiel 24:18, his wife died, and what did God say? Don't mourn for her. There was going to be a lesson into that to the Jews, and they ended up asking, what's all this about? And Ezekiel told them. But Ezekiel had a wife. We've got no reference to Daniel having a wife, so that might add to the idea of him actually having been made a eunuch. He may also have been a member of the royal family, a member of the house of David. Notice what verse 3 said. Nebuchadnezzar called Ashpenaz to take some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants, as well as some nobles. Now, I don't know that we can nail down with absolute certainty that he was among the king's descendants, but it's possible. And Josephus said he was. Josephus is not gospel, but Josephus tells us in his Antiquities, now among these young men, he writes, were 4 of the family of Zedekiah, that of course is the king, the one of whom was called Daniel, and then he mentions the other 3. So, that lends some credence to the possibility that Daniel was in fact a descendant of the king, as perhaps does the prophecy. Remember all the way back in the days of Hezekiah. Hezekiah was sick, and Berodach-Baladan, king of Babylon, sends some people over with a present and some letters. They come over to visit Hezekiah, and what's Hezekiah do? Hezekiah shows them all around. I don't know why he did that. Is it like showing somebody your house when they first come to visit? I don't know, but he shows them all around. And Isaiah comes to him and says, what did these men say and what did they see? And Hezekiah says, they saw everything. There was nothing that I have I didn't show them. And remember, Isaiah said, well, that very same people is going to come here and they're going to take everything your fathers have accumulated. And in 2 Kings 20, verse 18, Isaiah goes on to say, and they shall take some of your sons who will descend from you, whom you will beget, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. I like the idea of Daniel 1 giving us the fulfillment of 2 Kings 20:18. It certainly is, but I like the idea of it being specific to Daniel. So we've got that the king's descendants were taken. We've got what Josephus says in the prophecy. So I think it's very possible Daniel was, in fact, of noble birth, which is kind of an interesting thing to consider. It was not something I had tuned into in time past. We also know from Daniel 1 that Daniel must have been a good-looking guy. That was the idea. Get men who are good-looking without blemish. This idea of blemish can mean moral as well as physical, but it's probably confined to physical here. Josephus said that these young men were remarkable for the beauty of their bodies and the comeliness of their countenance. Those were the kind of men to be gotten. So what some of us don't have, Daniel had. And it raises the question, why would this matter? Why does Nebuchadnezzar, you can understand why Nebuchadnezzar would want someone who's intelligent, which later on what we're going to read here seems to suggest that that would have been the case. You can understand why he would want men who are smart, who are going to get this information quickly, men who are young, who can learn it while they're still young, because they're going to have to be learning language, and that gets harder as we get older. I can understand all that, but why does this pagan king want good-looking guys? Well, we care about that sort of thing. It may have simply been from a carnal desire to have the court looking good. You know, how many of you have been to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier? Everybody here? I've never been, but you know, you see pictures of it. And of course, at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is a guard. And apparently this is a tremendous privilege among the military to be able to be one of these men who guards the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. The military and or the government is trying to convey a very definite picture when you go to visit. People from all over our country go to visit. People from perhaps all over the world come to visit. And they're going to see one soldier representing all the military. They are very, very specific requirements as to what that soldier is supposed to look like. He is supposed to be between 5'10 and 6'4". He is to be, quote, in superb physical condition. He is to be those heights with proportionate weight and build. I had heard that his waist could not be beyond 30 inches. Even if I was in good shape, I wouldn't be able to meet that requirement. There is a definite picture that is to be presented here. This is the, quote, unquote, this is what we're supposed to look like. This is to represent something, to impress. And that may be all that was behind this. But there does seem to have also been a notion among the Easterners that handsome form was connected with intelligence. I would think paying attention would destroy that notion pretty quickly. But I wasn't thinking of anyone in particular. Daniel must also have possessed a... this is getting started real good, aren't we? By Friday of next week, who knows? Chapter 1, verse 4 also said, at least in my New King James, that these young men were to possess knowledge. The ESV says, endowed with knowledge. The NIV, well informed. Daniel may already have been the beneficiary of previous schooling. Particularly if he's in the royal court, he would have had... or royal family, he would have had access to the best that Judah had to offer. That would have opened doors for him. So he may have already just stood out here as a very well-informed young man. It also may just be that he was adept at retaining the things he was exposed to. Some people are better at that than others. Their day-to-day experience, that knowledge accumulates very fast. And what he knew may have been understood to be indicative of what he could know. And so get us young men who already seem to know quite a bit, and we can be sure then they're going to acquire the information we're going to expose them to. And then the next thing there that verse 4 says in my New King James is that he was to be quick to understand. The King James Version says understanding science. And maybe it goes without saying, the word science here does not carry the meaning of our modern idea of that word. Gesenius just defines this word as knowledge. Now, admittedly, translations are all over the place on that particular phrase, so I don't quite know where to land. Maybe our best bet is just our best way of handling this is just take these last two qualities, knowledge, quick to understand, or whatever your translations say, and see Daniel as a young man who is bright. He garners information quickly. He's maybe already got quite a bit of information for his age. He learns things quickly. And the Babylonians see potential here. Here's a mind we can work with. Here's a mind we can fill with our ideas, our values, our information. And he can be helpful to us. And maybe we can also exploit the raw materials. And they did make use of him. Chapter 1, verse 5. Let's read that. The king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time, they might serve before the king. He was to be taught, in verse 4, the language and literature of the Chaldeans. 3 years, we're going to get at least a lot of this information in them. Now, by the way, we ought to maybe address for just a moment the idea of the Chaldeans here. If you've got in your book there, you probably already noticed that there's no place to take notes in what I sent, but there are some, hopefully, some study aids there. And the very first one has the kings, it says, of Neo-Babylonia. And you might be wondering what that's all about. You had the ancient kingdom of Babylon, the most notable king of which was whom? Did someone say Nebuchadnezzar? That's Neo-Babylonia. The old Babylon, Hammurabi. How many have heard of Hammurabi? Yeah, the code of Hammurabi. That was Babylon. While the Assyrians were in power, the Chaldean people, which it looks like may have come from the area of Ararat, interestingly, began to take over Babylon. And Nabopolassar, the first king there mentioned, 625 BC, he begins. Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar's father, is a Chaldean. So this is a different people. We call it the Babylonian Empire, and it is in a sense, but it's a different people than Hammurabi had been. So that explains why we've run into Chaldeans here, and why part of Daniel, by the way, is written in the Chaldee or Aramaic language. But be that as it may, he was going to be learning the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. It's interesting. Just as Moses, remember what Stephen said about Moses, Acts 7:22, Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Here was a man that God was going to make use of, and let's take him to the empire of the day, let's educate him, and then God's going to use him for his purposes. And we see the same thing with Daniel. Daniel is brought to the empire of his day. He's trained, given all these tools. Some of it's going to be bogus, but he's going to be bilingual. He's going to be able to influence a lot of people he never would have been able to do before. He's going to suddenly become more cosmopolitan, more influenced, and that gives God something that he can use more than he would have been able to otherwise. The literature of the Babylonians, of the Chaldeans here, I don't know all that would have included. I've heard of documents like the Enuma Elish, the Epic of Gilgamesh. I think these things may have belonged to the older Babylon. I don't know what this literature would have been, unless it may have included some astrology. The Babylonians were known for their astrology. The oldest known astrological book in existence was written in Babylonia in the 7th century, this very same century, the 500s B.C., and just along those lines, remember, it was Magi from the east who came, following a star, to come and see the young Jesus. And I think, well, there's a lot maybe we could say about that, but there may be some connection here. What's the purpose of all this? Why was Nebuchadnezzar even doing this? Why get a bunch of men of a nation that you've just subjugated and put the government's expense, teach them, and incorporate them into your service? Well, as far as the education goes, if they're going to be successful servants, they're going to need some education. I mean, these are Jews. They know Hebrew. We can't really do much with them, so let's educate them. And when among the Romans, do as the Romans do. If you're going to work with Babylonians, learn to do as the Babylonians do. A level of education is going to be necessary to carry out the tasks. There's maybe a form of indoctrination going on in here. We're not going to be able to make use of these men if the only thing they know or believe is this stuff that they were taught over there. let's get some new ideas, some truer ideas perhaps into their minds. But I think maybe more than anything, it's just a very savvy political decision. Put yourself in the position of a captive Jew. The temple has not yet been destroyed, but you've been taken from your homeland. You've now been subjugated, demoralized. Here you are in this foreign country, foreign customs, foreign language. What in your heart of hearts, if you've got any fight left in you, what do you want to do? Fight, run, get out of here, not acquiesce. Every time they try to get you to do something, your inclination is going to be to fight it. But then you find out that the government has actually taken the king's descendants, the people who would have ruled over you anyway. They're taking them and they're going to incorporate them in the government. And as the years go by, you see that these people who would have ruled over you anyway, look, they know the language, they're interacting in the government, they seem to be well adapted. What's that going to do to you? Well, they're doing it, and it seems to be all right, and maybe this isn't so bad. And 70 years later, 536, when Cyrus said, anyone who wants to go home can go, what happened? A smidgen went home. Less than 50,000. Babylon wasn't such a bad place after all. Politically, it was very savvy and very successful. Let's talk about Daniel's political life. We know he remained in Babylon past the time of the first return. That first return came in the first year of Cyrus, Ezra chapter 1, verse 1. We know Daniel stayed in Babylon past that because in Daniel 10, I'm going to turn over there real quick. Maybe we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but Daniel chapters 10, 11, and 12 are one chunk. And that's where the book closes, of course. Daniel 10, verse 1 reads, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar. And notice what Daniel says down in verse 4. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was by the side of the great river, that is the Tigris. So it's the third year of Cyrus, 2 years since his people have headed back, and he's still in Babylon. And it has been the common opinion among historians that that is where Daniel died. I can't prove that, but it does seem reasonable. Why did he stay behind? If he's such a righteous man, why did he stay behind? Well, if he was 15 in 606, at 536, how old is he? He's 85. Well, yeah, but we read in Ezra how there were some old men there. All right, sure enough, so be it. But it may not have been an easy trip. Plus, he's in government, and he's been in government years. And he may love to go back, but how is he going to most be able to assist his people? It might be stay right here, stay with the government, and make sure I can give everything they need to them. So we speculate a little bit, but in 1543, a publication was printed called Itinerary by a Jew by the name of Benjamin Tudela. He was a Jewish rabbi from Spain, and he spent about 13 years or so traveling through Africa, Asia, and Africa, Asia, and Europe, and he did some writing about the things he saw or learned, and he writes, now again, this is 12th century AD, but he writes that in the province of Khuzestan, which was biblical Elam, he writes that there were some 7,000 Jews living there. This is over in the area of Babylon. There were some 7,000 Jews living there. They had 14 synagogues, and in front of one of those synagogues was the tomb of Daniel. Now, that may not be the only place that's claimed to be the tomb of Daniel, and it's a long time after Daniel. That's closer to us than it was to Daniel. But it's a possible thing that confirming his death over there. Daniel chapter 1, verse 19 tells us that after Daniel underwent the 3 years of training, that after being interviewed by Nebuchadnezzar, he was placed to serve before the king. He only rose from there. Remember in chapter 2, after he interprets the dream, verse 48. I'll turn over there and read that. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province. This is 248. Made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. So he goes from serving before the king to now being placed in this position of authority over the province of Babylon and over the wise men. And then over in chapter 5, years later, the night Belshazzar ends up falling to Cyrus, Belshazzar promotes him to third in the kingdom. which is an interesting thing, and I will reserve that for chapter 5, but it is an interesting question. Why, if the king's so desperate and so scared his knees are knocking together, why is he only offering third place in the kingdom? There is an explanation for that, and I know some of you know it, but we'll wait till we get to chapter 5 to get to that. He continued to excel while under the Persians. Remember when Darius the Mede overtook Babylon? Daniel chapter 6, verse 2. The Babylonians had the Persians had their kingdom divided up into 120 satrapies. These satraps, like governor-like officials, ruled over these provinces. And Daniel's made of one of three men who reign over all of them. So extremely high position. And then you'll recall in chapter 6, verse 3, that Darius was actually giving thought to just putting Daniel over the whole thing. Giving him something very much like what Joseph seems to have had. It is possible, as I've already mentioned, that Daniel's position in the court may have given him the ability to significantly affect government on behalf of the Jews. And in fact, Jewish tradition even says that Daniel took the prophecies of Cyrus to Cyrus and showed them him, and that that was part of what prompted Cyrus to make the decree that they could go back and get to work on the temple. Don't know if it's true or not, but you can see it possibly being true. Daniel's life does parallel that of Joseph's, doesn't it? Here are two men who are basically taken captive and who over time make their way up to the very highest position available to them aside from the crown, or very nearly get there. And for similar reasons. Both have the ability to interpret dreams. Both are gifted by God. But also, when God's gifts open doors for them, they step through and do so competently. And there's a lesson for us there, I think. You know, God blesses us all with gifts and abilities. And opportunities is maybe the better place here. And when you get those opportunities, what do you do with them? What do you do with them? When the door is open, be it to spread the gospel with someone or to do good work in the church, to be a help to your neighbor, when the door is open, what do you do? Are you inclined to stand there? Are you inclined to just kind of put your foot through? Or are you like a Daniel and a Joseph and you barrel on through and say, Lord, help me do it the best I can? It's very good examples. We're going to turn our attention to the book after talking about the man. Any comments or questions on what I've shared so far? All right, let's keep moving. Daniel, the book, has the unusual quality of being written nearly half in Hebrew and half in Chaldee or Aramaic, which was the lingua franca of much of the Mideastern world at that time. If you're wanting to mark it in your Bible, or if you don't have it marked, starting in Daniel chapter 2, verse 4, and going all the way to Daniel chapter 7, verse 28, this portion of the book is written in the Aramaic language. Prior and after, it is written in Hebrew. There's only one other book of the Old Testament that is like this, where it's written in two different languages. It's not nearly to this extent, but does anyone happen to know what book that is? It's Ezra. Ezra. Ezra chapter... I have that in front of me here. Ezra chapter 7. I'll just put that up here. Ezra 7... verses 12 through 26 are also written in Aramaic. And that happens to be Artaxerxes I's decree concerning the second return. So it comes in the language, apparently, that it was issued in. Now the question does arise, why is Daniel organized this way? I mean, it's not like the first six chapters are in one language and the next six chapters in another language. You've got this break. Well, if you look at chapter 2, verse 4, it's kind of neat where the break is, because it's not at the beginning of the verse. Daniel chapter 2, verse 4, after Nebuchadnezzar had this dream, the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, and that's where it begins. So, it's a natural starting point. It doesn't stop, though. I mean, once they're done talking, it continues to go in Aramaic, and then closes out chapter 7 in that language. When you get to chapter 8, verse 1, we're back to Hebrew. So the question's still there. You can kind of see why it was that way in verse 4 of chapter 7, but why does it continue to be that way? And the short answer is, I don't know. I can offer some possibilities. Nebuchadnezzar has some royal proclamations here in chapters 3 and chapter 4. So just as we had in Ezra, where Artaxerxes' the first proclamation was in Aramaic, you could see where it would be reasonable to put Nebuchadnezzar's proclamations in chapters 3 and 4 in Aramaic. But that still doesn't answer why so much of the rest of it is. One of the reasons that's been suggested, and the more I've thought about it, the more I think there might be something to it, is that the content concurs with the language. In other words, the idea is that in the portions of the book that are written in Hebrew, that is prophecy and events that would be of special relevance to the Hebrews, whereas where it's written in Aramaic, it would have special relevance to a broader audience. Like the New Testament being written in Greek as opposed to Hebrew. The Old Testament's written in Hebrew because it's for the Jews. The New Testament's written in Greek, it's for everybody. And I think there might be something to that, and I'll explain to you why. In chapter 2, and we'll hit these as we go through the study, but in chapter 2, in chapter 3, in chapter 4, and in chapter 6, all in this Aramaic portion, three times we have Nebuchadnezzar, one time we have Darius, making proclamations declaring the glory and superiority of the one true and living God. Here is this obscure, historically irrelevant people, the Jews, with this God. Theirs is the one true and living God, but if you're all these people of the world, you've got no reason to believe that. Every nation's got their God, we've got ours, and we can be prospering better than they are. But now suddenly you have King Nebuchadnezzar, you have King Darius, the kings of the empires of that part of the world, declaring in this language, for the normal reader to freely read, how there is this God who's better than all the others, who is above the others. Now that's the pagan point of view, of course, because he's the only one. But they were moving in the right direction. And that may have been God's plan all along. Make the message of the one true and living God available to a broader Eastern audience. And then, of course, when Alexander comes along, we get Greek for everybody, and the stage is set for the gospel to arrive. But these evangelistic proclamations, if you want to put them that way, are in the language of the people. The book is, of course, I think, you know, I don't know how familiar we all are with Daniel, but the book, for most of us, many of us, I think, realize it's basically two parts. Chapters 1 through 6 are narrative. Chapters 7 through 12 are predictive prophecy, apocalyptic prophecy. The only thing I'll mention about the narrative parts are that, interestingly, Daniel, even though it's just narrative, even though it's just story, every chapter in Daniel, with the possible every chapter of the first six, with the possible exception of chapter 1, contains something supernatural, which is interesting. I'm not sure every chapter in the Bible would be like that. But that's the case with Daniel, and maybe even chapter 1. Chapter 7 through 12 are apocalyptic. I'll explain to you what I mean by that. Apocalyptic comes from the Greek word that's used there in Revelation 1. The word for Revelation, apokalypsis, apocalyptic. And just like in Revelation, we've got all these symbols and images which are predicting things, but are predicting them in a somewhat obscure fashion. So, of course, Daniel is doing. The things are being revealed, but they're not being revealed in such a way that we know what's going to happen until they've happened. And then it's like, oh, yeah, this fits perfectly. But it's revealing in kind of a hidden way. It's been said, and I think somewhat fairly, that Daniel is to the Old Testament what Revelation is to the New Testament. There is a lot they have in common. Both of them, if we accept a late date for Revelation, which we've got evidence for, came at times of great adversity for God's people. Daniel, of course, is in captivity. In Revelation, there would have been if that date's right, Domitian's persecutions at the end of the first century. Both of them promise that after much hardship and struggle for God's people, and just when God's enemies seem to have victory all sewed up, God will bring deliverance. And it will be a great deliverance. And the enemies will be crushed, and God's people will win. Understanding these prophecies of Daniel, which may seem so difficult and so up for grabs to so many people, it is important. It's not just intriguing. It's not just an interesting academic pursuit. It's important. And it's not just important for a study of Revelation. Where else in the New Testament can I go to find Daniel being quoted? In other words, what Daniel said becomes integral to understanding something the New Testament is teaching me. Jesus, absolutely. Matthew 24, let's just turn over there really quick. Matthew chapter 24, Jesus, of course, is rehearsing what would go on prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. Later gets to the end of time. But Matthew 24, verse 15, he's warning those who are listening how to know when to get out of Jerusalem before this destruction, unlike any beforehand, comes. He says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand, then... let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Now, Jesus is talking to Jewish listeners, and of course, they're going to be familiar with Daniel. But if we're going to understand what Jesus is saying, we've got to be familiar with Daniel, at least certain parts of it. We have an abomination of desolation mentioned in chapters 11, chapter 12, and something very similar, or perhaps the very same thing, in chapter 9, verse 27. We come to the book of 2 Thessalonians. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. Paul writes of this man of sin, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, showing himself that he is God. That sounds like things we've read in Daniel. In Daniel 7, verse 8, we've got that little horn. He's got the eyes of a man. And he has got a mouth speaking pompous words, the kind of words we would expect from someone claiming the prerogatives of deity. He speaks pompous words against the Most High. So if I'm going to appreciate what Jesus says in Matthew 24, and perhaps what Paul says in 2 Thessalonians 2, I've got to have Daniel under my belt. And I most certainly have got to have Daniel under my belt if I'm going to understand Revelation. I remember being, 8, 9, 10 years old. Fred Miners came down to our class downstairs, maybe on a Wednesday evening or something. He was going to be teaching it the next quarter. What do you want to study? Of course, Revelation. And how many people do you talk to? And if they have an interest in studying with you, or you're able to get a little interest in, what is it they want to study? Revelation. The first thing they want to study is the last thing, probably, they're ready for. And it is a fascinating book, and you can understand it, but they understand the desire, but God seems to have set it up where Daniel is the stepping stone. You can't march into the halls of Revelation knowingly or prepared to understand it until you've spent some time in the book of Daniel. And just as a couple of examples, let's look at Revelation 12. We're not going to break these down, but we just want to point out the similarity in language. Even if you don't have a clue what Revelation is about, if you've read Daniel chapter 7, Revelation 12 and 13 sounds very familiar. Revelation chapter 12, notice verse 14. John says, "But the woman who was standing on the moon earlier, but the woman was given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent." Jump down to verse 17. "And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ." If I've read Daniel 7, that sounds very familiar. Daniel 7:25 speaks of a time and times and half a time. 7:21 talks to this little horn making war against the saints, which may be connected to this. Revelation 13:1-2, John says, "I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his head a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion." And again, Daniel 7, we've got those four beasts that come up out of the sea, right in that order. We've got a lion, something like a lion, something like a bear, something like a leopard. And the fourth one, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong, with the ten horns. All these things are very familiar to us, and it is the intention, and maybe I'm just stating the obvious here, but I think it is the intention of God that we understand Daniel before we try to really make sense of Revelation. So, with that said, let's turn our attention to one more aspect of our introduction, which is relevant, I think very relevant, because we have a lot of people, anyone who cares to pay any attention, a number of people at least, who may look you straight in the eye and say to you, "Well, yeah, your book of Daniel is interesting, but I don't believe it. I believe that the symbols match up with the historical events that they purport to predict, but I don't believe their predictions." Has anyone here ever talked to an individual who called into question the genuineness of the book of Daniel? It's a pretty small category of conversation, especially in our era where no one cares. But there have been a lot of people down through the years who have called into question Daniel's prophecies. And it really boils down, or Daniel, because of its prophecy. We'll get to chapter 11 next week, God permitting. But chapter 11, I said this to Tom over at the camp out, and I hope he didn't mind me saying it, but and this is probably not a very good introduction to the chapter either, but chapter 11 is full of history that Will Durant has called dead history. It's history that very few people know much about and even fewer people care about, possibly. It was very relevant to the nation of Israel, but the predictions made there are very, very specific, and they go hand in glove with the history we have of these Greek empires that were affecting the nation of Israel in the 2nd century BC, 3rd and 2nd centuries. And it is so clear that even the skeptics have admitted it. Well, yeah, it does match up, but their contention has been it matches up because it was written after the fact. And they call it post-eventum prophecy. I'm sure
sure I'm not pronouncing that right. It's Latin. Post eventum, I think, might be more correct.
After the fact. Then it's a charade that the writer claims to be Daniel. That the writer, he put together all these symbols that, yeah, match up with the history to make it look like it was predicted beforehand. But it was all written in the second century after the events predicted. They can't deny the correlations, so they deny when it was written. Porphyry was probably the, based on my reading anyway, was the first open and avowed adversary to the book of Daniel. He wrote in the 3rd century, he wrote 15 books against Christianity. What a way to spend your life. All of which are lost. We can be glad for that. But some fragments have been preserved by Eusebius, Jerome, and others. And this was his contention, that the book was not written by Daniel. It was written by someone else who lived in Judea, not Babylon, and who lived at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, one of the main figures of Daniel 11, not during the time of Nebuchadnezzar and so forth. And he's only been one of many to argue this. And I was surprised. Albert Barnes points out in his commentary on Daniel that among those who have called into question Daniel's book, whole or in part, has been Gesenius. And I know some of you, that may not mean a lot, but Gesenius is a Hebrew scholar. If you're trying to figure out what Hebrew words mean and you want something more than Strong's, Gesenius is a pretty good book to turn to, I think, and one that many of us do turn to. But here's a guy who apparently doubted some about the book of Daniel. I don't know the details on that, but it was striking to see that. Anyone? I'm not seeing the clock. Anyone here who's done some studying on this, what are some of the reasons cited for doubting, what are supposedly some of the reasons for doubting Daniel's reliability?
History doesn't always match up with modern history.
All right. There are historical inaccuracies. We'll address that in a moment. What else? Okay.
Too good.
It's too good? What do you mean by that?
It's too accurate.
Okay. Some have said it's not true because it's full of all these wonderful things. I guess they mean by that miracles. That's an interesting argument because it assumes its conclusion right out of the gate. I've not seen miracles in my life. I don't see them in other people's lives. Therefore, miracles have never happened. And so because there are miracles in this book, it must be bogus. That assumes omniscience on the part of a person. Even if you have never seen a miracle in your life or in the life of others, you still have no proof that it's never happened. The present is not always the key to the past, and everybody knows that if they think about it long enough. Ultimately, the claims of the book of Daniel and whether or not its miracles are true or not must be based, our understanding of them must be based on the book itself. Do we have evidence to suggest that it was written when it claims to be, and are these prophecies true? And if so, then God is at work among men, and I accept it. And if there is a God and He is at work among men, I expect miracles. So it's kind of like the David Hume thing. We just write these things off because it's a philosophical argument, not a scientific one. We reject the book of Daniel because it's full of historical inaccuracies. Claims like this. Ancient historians like Berosus, Abdinus, Xenophon, Herodotus, they never mention some of many of the significant events that are mentioned in the book of Daniel. They mention some of the people from the book of Daniel, but they don't mention these events. Therefore, Daniel's history must be inaccurate. I'm stealing this quote from someone else, but I like it. The silence of history proves nothing except the silence of history. Amber's paternal grandmother, Cariella, many of you know, she took it upon herself to write a biography of her life, I'm assuming for the benefit of grandchildren and so forth. She did this some time back. It's about a couple of pages long. Now, it may be full of accurate material, but how much of her life is recorded there? Next to nothing. We look in the book of John, and what does John tell us? That if all that Jesus did was written, I suppose the world would not be able to contain the books. History is always selective. It is a characterization of what happened. It is never a detailed account of all that happened. So just because historians leave these events out proves nothing. Absence of proof is not proof of absence. And you just wonder how many times the skeptics have to experience having their presumption upended. I mean, we've had cases where, well, the Hittites are bogus. You know, I know the Bible talks about them, but we don't have any historical evidence for it. And of course, the archaeological discoveries turn that on its head. Oh, we doubt things about the Assyrians, and then we find Nineveh. We doubt Belshazzar. Yeah, Daniel chapter 5 mentions Belshazzar, but all the other historical accounts we have, ancient sources, mention that Nabonidus was king when they fell to the Persians. So Daniel's bogus. And then in 1879, a tablet now known as the Nabonidus Chronicle, I've got a picture of it up here, some of you would like to see it later. The British Museum comes into possession of the Nabonidus Chronicle. In 1882, after it's translated, the translation was published, and lo and behold, there's Belshazzar, just like Daniel had been saying all along. And again, we'll talk more about that in chapter 5. But I don't know how many times this has happened, and I guess if you don't want to believe, you don't believe, and you find ways to reason around these things. In the next 2 weeks, God permitting, we're going to be going through this book, and we're going to see where a number of historians who have no reason to try to argue for Daniel confirm Daniel. So the historical argument is very empty when searched out. One of the other arguments that is made against the book, and to me it's one of the more interesting, is that the language of the book itself argues against Daniel having been written in the 6th century B.C. And what they mean by that is there are Greek words in Daniel. Not that they're in the Greek language, but that they are Hebraized or Aramaicized or however you say that, versions of these Greek words. And this shows, they argue, that it must have been the result of Greek influence, because after all, in that 2nd century B.C., the Hebrews were under the Greeks, so this fits. He's writing, he's trying to make it look like he wrote it 350 years ago or whatever, but he can't get around the fact that a little bit of that Greek got in anyway. Now, that, I like language. Some of you are thinking, oh, please don't talk any more about this. I'm going to talk a little bit more about it. Bear with me. I think that some of it's interesting. That one has piqued my interest. And I looked into it a little bit. And if you'll bear with me, I want to go through some of these terms that they claim are Greek. And I want to say from the outset that it is true. Some of their claims may be bogus, but there are Greek words, it appears, in the book of Daniel. So, to some extent, there is a point being made here. There's disagreement on how many. One author says 10, one author says 4, but they are there, and we'll talk about that as well. Chapter 1, verse 3, when Nebuchadnezzar says to Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, what kind of men to get, you know, he talks about the king's descendants and so forth, and he says some of the nobles, or your King James says princes. In the Hebrew, in English characters, this is the word. Chapter 1, verse 3, for princes or nobles. Here's the Hebrew word, partemim. Now, it has been alleged that this is the same, this is a Hebrew version of this Greek word. Make sure I've got that spelled right. Don't. Now, for those of us who don't do a lot with linguistics, we might look at that and go, those really don't look all that much the same. But when words come through other languages, and I mean, look at this. We're looking at a Hebrew word in English characters and a possible Greek word in English characters. So we're getting it through all the... And this one supposedly came through this language and then came into English. So we may not be able to fully appreciate why someone would think these things are related. But we have an author out there who would say, yes, this is the Greek word and it has been brought over into the Hebrew here. Well, for one, not everyone would agree with that. Gesenius, who is this scholar, he says, no, I think this word's of Persian origin. So that alone tells us that the scholars are not agreed. They're not standing on solid ground. It has also been argued that this word appears in the book of Esther, a book which maybe less than Daniel at least has been questioned less. So if this is, in fact, a Greek word, why not call Esther into question the same degree? I don't know a whole lot about the Esther question, but the fact that Gesenius says it's not the same, I think that's interesting. There's another word, chapter 3, verse 16, the word that's translated matter, or matter, and is translated decision, chapter 4, verse 17. Chapter 3, verse 16, when the three Hebrew children, they say, you know, we don't have to answer the king in this matter. That's the word. It's this word in Hebrew characters. And it's been argued that it is this Greek word. Problem with this line of reasoning is that this Hebrew word appears also not only in Esther, but in Ezra and Ecclesiastes. Way back there. Ecclesiastes, of course, written way back, long before this. So, and Gesenius again says, no, I think the origin of this word should be sought in Persian. So, another argument which doesn't come across very strong. Let me give you one more, and then we're going to look at four, which will be a little more interesting. This third one appears in chapter 2, verse 6. And see if I can get it spelled right here. I'm not going to try to pronounce that.
The Greek word that thought this comes from is nomisma.
Do we have any coin collectors in the audience? Okay, numismatic. If you're a coin collector, you're a numismatic. This word refers to money in the Greek. It's translated rewards in our translations, which is interesting to me. I looked at a number of translations and found that none of them translate this word money. Not in chapter 2, verse 6. Not in chapter 5, verse 17. They translate it rewards. Gesenius writes that the word may have a Chaldean origin and that the idea of money, which is implied in the Greek word, is foreign to the context in Daniel. So again, the whoever's making this claim is not getting the support of some of the other scholars. I realize I haven't given a whole lot of conclusive proof one way or the other. Could these be Greek words? Maybe. There are scholars who certainly think they are not. There are four words, though, in the book of Daniel, which are, it appears, Greek. At least there's good reason to believe they are. And they're all in chapter 3. If you want to turn with me over to chapter 3. Chapter 3. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar has built his image, and he wants everyone to bow down to this image. And how will they know when to bow? When the music plays. And there is a number of instruments listed here. I'll just go ahead and read verse 5. That at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Okay, I'm going to write these things up here. The word that is translated harp in my New King James in verse 5 is this word right here, kithara. It looks an awful lot like the Greek word katharos. The Greek word that is translated lyre or sackbut in your King James in verse 5 is this Hebrew word, or Aramaic word here. And here is the Greek equivalent. The one that's translated dulcimer in your King James or symphony in my New King James is this right here in the Hebrew. Aramaic again, I'm sorry. Here it is in the Greek. And finally, the one that's translated psaltery in chapter 3, verse 5. Am I getting these big enough, David?
Yes.
Okay. So the skeptic will say, you might beat around the others, and yeah, maybe not everyone agrees, but these sure like Greek words, and perhaps these are names of Greek instruments. Does the presence of these words, if they are in fact Greek, prove that Daniel had a late date authorship? No. And let me ask you just from a logical standpoint. Okay, let's say Daniel, in writing these things, lists these instruments, and they are in fact go by Greek names. He brings them into his language, but they go by Greek names. Why does that not prove the claim they are making? Sure. We can use Greek instruments. I was talking to Colin a little while ago. For those of you who were at the camp out, you saw the act. It's all indescribable. But you saw the act. And Colin had this big, long tube. And it's called a didgeridoo. Is he here to confirm this? What is it?
Didgeridoo.
Thank you. Didgeridoo. And it comes from Australia. And now, we just said didgeridoo. I don't know where this word originated from. Is it, maybe some of the natives there. I have just said didgeridoo. You can put that in your notes. Someone can read those notes 100 years from now. I have gleaned a word from another language. But that has nothing to do with when I said it or what. All it has to do is with these cultures interacted and I learned something about another culture. We know that the Greeks traveled into the East to gain knowledge, which they valued so much. It makes perfect sense that as people went, so did instruments and ideas and languages. That makes perfect sense. We see that today, and very well it's happening then. Something else that's interesting, though, is Strabo, who was a Greek geographer, philosopher, and historian. He lived between 63 BC about and about 24 AD. So he's right around the time when Jesus was born and so forth. He's a Greek. And he states that the names of the Greek instruments, or mostly at least, were of Greek derivation. I get this from Albert Barnes. So he's saying, yeah, we've got these instruments, but pardon me, they were foreign derivation. In other words, we're using these names, but we ourselves got them from somewhere else, these names and or these instruments. And Athenaeus, who was a Greek rhetorician and grammarian, he affirms, for example, that the lyre, that they got that from, that was of Syrian origin, the word if not the instrument. I'm going to use an example as we close out here, and it's kind of corny, but it illustrates the point. We got three countries. Country A, I'm very inventive. Country B, and we've got country C. And it's about 500 years since these countries were flourishing, and we're studying their languages. And we learned that over here in country A, something got invented. It's called Google. And based on our studies, we've looked at country B, and we find out that country B, maybe we don't even know that country A invented it, but over here in country B, they're using the same thing, but their language doesn't allow them to make the oo sound. Languages are like that. Chinese language, as I understand it, does not have an ul sound for L. There you get the joke singing fa-ra-ra-ra-ra rather than fa-la-la-la-la. And languages are like this. I was in Ghana in 2000, West Africa. There, one of the languages they spoke right there is that. I do not know how to pronounce that. I was there for 2 weeks and I still do not know how to pronounce that word. They were making a sound that I never could get out of my mouth. If I'd worked hard enough, I think maybe I could have gotten it finally, but I never did get it. And their language, and there are a whole host of sounds that the human vessel is able to make. But when you grow up in a certain language, you only make a certain number of those, and the older you get, the harder it is to make any of the others. So you know that the Hebrew sound is kind of this guttural sound that maybe is harder, if not impossible, for some of us to make. So over here in country B, they're using the same thing, but they're calling it Google. And then we're researching country C over here, and we find out that they're using something very similar, the same thing, but they call it Goggle. Now, we know that country B learned it from country A. Maybe they're right next to each other. Country A invented it, country B picked it up from that country. All we know is that country C had the same thing, and they called it this. Where did they get the term? Maybe they got it straight from here. Maybe they got it from Syria. Maybe they got it from Greece. Maybe Gogol and Goggle, they both got it from the same place. In other words, just because we have in Daniel 3 a term which matches up with Greek, doesn't necessarily mean it came directly from the Greek. It's an obvious concept, but it's an important one. And my time is up. I've got, I guess, maybe 30 seconds. Anyone have a comment or question? Okay, we're going to pick up tomorrow making some arguments for the authenticity apart from these objections, and then we can get into the book.